Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Before we start, I have a couple of housekeeping notes. The Second City has gone from stage to screen and really everything in between. Our live shows in Chicago will be resuming on May 7th with limited capacity in our main stage theater. Look for our other stages to open up in the coming weeks and months. We're also resuming some live in-person classes, corporate shows, and learning sessions. We continue to have virtual offerings in all these areas, as well as hybrid offerings. You can get all the information you need at secondcity.com.
Welcome to the world of Tony Ho from CBC Podcasts. It's an award-winning, bite-sized narrative comedy series about human relationships, familiar, hilarious, and sometimes unnerving. The troupe features Miguel Rivas, Adam Niebergall, and alumnus of the Second City main stage, Roger Bainbridge. They will take you on a darkly comedic ride that finds honesty in every situation. You can listen and subscribe to Tony Ho on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
We welcome back Kim Scott to the podcast, not to talk about radical candor, though we do touch on that, but we talk about her new book, which is called Just Work, Get Shit Done Fast and Fair. I had the pleasure of reading early versions of this book, and the finished copy is just unbelievable. I have a lot of feelings like I did when Radical Candor came out, that I was like, oh, this is just... you know, well-written, good storytelling and practical advice. And in this case, around issues of bias and prejudice and bullying and harassment and how all that exists in business. And it's our job to eradicate it. And that's not easily done. So enjoy this conversation.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting the Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking.
Kim Scott, welcome back to the show.
Kelly, it is great to see you and hear you.
Yeah, I think you have the most appearances on the Getting DSM podcast. you're my Alec Baldwin.
That is a tremendous honor. Thank you. Thank you.
I don't know that the Alec Baldwin part is the honor, but yeah, we'll go with it. So I actually read some early drafts of your new book, and I finished the final copy this past weekend, and I was struck by this feeling that you wrote a book that evolved over the course of the writing to be informed not only by the events unfolding in our culture and society, but also by facing your own growth in an attempt to be the best human being you can be. Is that a fair description?
Yes. And it also incorporated a tremendous amount of feedback from a lot of wonderful and brilliant people. So I think I wrote this in a Google document. I think there were about 150 collaborators at one point.
Wow.
So there was a lot of feedback, and the book got a lot better, I think, as a result. So many thanks to people like you who read it and said, oh, this doesn't feel just right. That doesn't feel just right. Who read the stories that I was telling and said, Kim, you didn't even notice that, you know, you're mm-hmm. in denial here. And so it was definitely a self-evolution and a evolution of thinking as well.
Okay, so it's very different from Radical Candor, though it references Radical Candor throughout, which is appropriate. And I want to talk a bit about the premise of the book, which you state so early about workplace injustice And you cite that it's six different problems: bias, prejudice, bullying, discrimination, verbal harassment, and physical violence. And I think what was important, and this was true of Radical Candor too, is giving very specific words to the things that we're experiencing, because we don't. And all the bad shit that happens is in when things are vague. Was that your thinking in terms of the early definitions here?
Yeah, absolutely. In the introduction of the book, I tell a story about my very first job out of college. And all of those things, all of those six things happened to me in that one job. And it took me 30 years to process what had happened and to try to disentangle it. It's really interesting. You know, this morning I woke up and there was a headline in the Times about what had happened in Atlanta. And it references the murder of these women. And then it says, there's fears about anti-Asian bias. And what happened was murder. It was not, bias is really bad, don't get me wrong. And there's a well-worn path from anti-locution to violence. Mm-hmm. But to conflate the two things in that one headline, it made me wince. It has been on my mind all day long. So I think it really is very helpful to disentangle these different attitudes and behaviors and because we can't, as Kimberly Crenshaw says, we can't fix it if we can't name it. And we've got to name these different things and not conflate bias with violence. These are two very related but different problems.
And I think too, you say early in the book that, quote, the only way we can combat workplace injustice is if we move forward together.
Yes. And
that is a really important message right now, because we don't want to do anything together.
No. And yet, you know, it's really interesting that this book was born probably right after I published, or St. Martin's Press published, Radical mm-hmm. Candor. And I was giving a presentation in San Francisco at a tech company. And the CEO of that company was an old friend of mine and a former colleague, and one of too few Black women CEOs in tech. And mm-hmm. after I gave the presentation, she pulled me aside and she said, "Kim, I got to tell you, I really like Radical Candor. I think it's going to help me create the kind of culture I want, but it's much harder for me to put it into practice than it is for you. And I'd be willing to bet it's harder for you to put it into practice than it is for your husband, who's a white engineer in Silicon Valley." And she said, "When I offer someone even the gentlest, kindest, most compassionate criticism, I very often get slimed with the angry Black woman stereotype."
Yeah.
And I knew this was true. And I felt like my head was going to explode because I was having so many different realizations at the same time. The first was that I had not been the kind of colleague to her that I wanted to be. I had not been an upstander, because I had known her for the better part of a decade, and I had never recognized the extent to which she was always cheerful and positive. She never seemed even the slightest bit annoyed. And believe me, she had what to be pissed off about in the course of that mm-hmm. decade. And I had been in denial about the things that were happening to her. And moreover, as she pointed out to me, I was also in denial about the things that were happening to me. And as Ibram X. Kendi said, denial is the heartbeat of racism. It's also the heartbeat of sexism and of all manner of injustices that plague us.
To say that this book can be triggering. I mean, you know, and again, as a white man, I am at the top of the white cisgendered man. I'm at the top of the privileged mountain. But I also realized in reading this book that I was bullied. And I was humiliated. Those were not words I would have ever put to this stuff. And it felt a little bit therapeutic to do so.
Yeah, it did for me. I mean, certainly the book helped me process the things that had happened to me. And I tried to write it in a way that would also help everyone process, because we all experience all of these things. Both as people harmed and as people causing harm, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And this is another thing that was really hard for me in the course of writing this book, is I never wanted to think of myself as a victim, but even less did I want to think of myself as a perpetrator. Right. And yet I was both very often in the same meeting. I was both and sort of coming to grips. I don't think we can solve this problem unless we can come to grips with that. And as my son's baseball coach said, you can't do right if you don't know what you're doing wrong. And yet it's hard. It's hard to notice it.
Yeah. Our shame brains don't want to go there.
No.
So let's talk a little bit about the differences between bias, prejudice, and bullying, because you have a really neat sort of structure in terms of the word meaning. Can you want to take us through that?
Yeah. So I don't love long definitions, so I'm going to give you some super short definitions. Bias to me is not meaning it. Prejudice to me is meaning it. And bullying is being mean. So there's a world of difference between these three things. And there's a world of difference in the way that we need to respond to these three things. So I'll give you an example. Bias is the kind of stuff that probably happens in every meeting, in every organization, in every day. There's a lot of bias out there. So and how can we respond effectively? Simple example. My friend Aileen Lee, who actually was an investor in a failed company, but seems to have forgiven me. So thank you, Aileen, told a really good story about going into a meeting with two colleagues who were men, and they're meeting with this partner, about five men on the other side. So they walk into the, meeting room, this long conference table. They sit down side by side. The first guy from the other company comes in, sits across from the man. Then the next guy sits across from the other man, and then everybody else extends on down the table. So Aileen is off all by herself on the side. Mm-hmm. So that's whatever. It's a little awkward, but she's actually really the expert who needs to pitch the deal that they're trying to get done. And so she starts talking, and it's as though she hasn't spoken. The guys on the other side of the table start talking to her two male colleagues. And eventually, one of the men who Aileen worked with realized what was happening, and he stood up and he said, "I think Aileen and I should switch seats." And when he did that, it changed the whole dynamic in the room. Yeah. And he did it. It's really important, I think, to understand why he did it. He did it in part because he cared about Aileen and he didn't like the way she was being treated. But he also did it because he wanted to win the deal, and he knew that Aileen had the skills that were going to win the deal. And that's why I call it just work. Justice is really important. The sort of moral aspects of justice are really important, but the practical aspects of injustice is not only is it immoral, it's very inefficient. It's bad practically, and it's bad morally. So that's bias. And I think what her colleague did was he was an upstander and he used an I statement. And an I statement, I think, it invites other people in to understand the dynamics in the room from the way you see them. So that's bias. Now, prejudice, I'm kind of an optimist, sometimes in denial, as I said earlier. Mm-hmm. I like to believe there's no such thing as prejudice, but there is, unfortunately. So I tend to kind of assume it's all unconscious bias, but it is not. So sometimes people really believe that stuff. So a simple example of prejudice, I'm chit-chatting with this guy before a meeting, and he says to me, my wife doesn't work because it's better for the children. And I don't think he quite means it in the absolute sense that it sounded. And so I try to make a joke to let him off the hook. And I said, "Oh, I decided to show up at work today because I thought it would be a good idea to neglect my children."
Right.
And I'm expecting him to back off, but he doesn't. He doubles down. He's like, "Oh no, Kim, I had these studies. You should really read them. It's really bad that you're working." And so this is now not unconscious bias. He really believes this stuff. And people really believe all kinds of things out there. And so now I need to use what I refer to in the book as an it statement. And an it statement very clearly demarcates the line between one person's freedom to believe whatever they want. And I didn't want to have a debate about his beliefs with him. But they can't impose their beliefs on other people. You can't do or say whatever you want. And that's what so what I said to him was, "It is an HR violation for you to tell me I'm neglecting my children by showing up at work." And that had the desired impact of shutting him down. But I had to keep working with him. So I had to do a little bit more here. And it's unfortunate that I did, but the world is what it is. So I said, "Look, I'm not going to make a big deal of this with HR, but it's my decision with my spouse, how we raise our kids. And it's your decision with your spouse, how you raise yours. I've got a lot of studies that say something different than your studies. I don't guess you want to read my studies any more than you want to read mine. And then I want to read yours. And so we kind of, he understood at that point mm-hmm. that he couldn't keep doing this. And also, crucially, he understood that when it came time to allocating who was going to work on which clients, it was not his decision that I shouldn't travel, that I shouldn't have the out-of-town clients. I got to decide how I was gonna conduct my life and career and what I could and couldn't do. It was not his decision. So that's prejudice. And not, you know, it's wasn't an ideal situation, but it worked out okay. Now, you were going to say something.
Bullying.
Bullying, yes. Let's go on to bullying. So the story I want to tell you about bullying happened when I was the CEO and founder of the company that I was mm-hmm. where I was working. So I did not expect to, I thought I had solved the problem of bullying by becoming the CEO and founder of the company. Unfortunately, alas, I did not. So I'm giving this guy a performance review, and he's doing quite subpar work. So I'm trying to make sure he understands this and where the bar is, what the expectations are. And I said towards the end of the meeting, as I always try to do in these situations, what could I do or stop doing that would help you do better work? And he pauses and then he looks at me and he points at me and he says, "The problem here is that you are the most aggressive woman I ever met." And you know, if I was the most aggressive woman he ever met, I wasn't even on the top 100 most aggressive men he ever met. No. And furthermore, we are working in a super aggressive industry, and he had to be able to deal with that in order to get his job done. So his problem was obviously not with my aggression. His problem was with my gender, and that in my case was not going to change. Mm-hmm. And so what I should have done, not what I did do. And there's a lot of stories about woulda, coulda, shoulda in this book, mistakes I made. What I should have done is used a you statement to say, look, you cannot talk to me like that. And you cannot talk to any woman at this company like that. But I did not do that because this is one of the issues of being the underrepresented leader. Mm-hmm. I wasn't sure. I wanted to make sure that he knew he could give me feedback. And there's always an awkward situation where what you're getting is not feedback, but bullying. Mm-hmm. And so I erred on the side of remaining silent. And the problem with remaining silent in these situations is that bullying tends to escalate because it works for the bully. And also, if he was going to talk that way to me, how is he going to talk to women who were less senior in the company? How is he going to talk to other women in the company? And unfortunately, I had the opportunity to see not long after that. We were at a company meeting, an all hands meeting where we served the obligatory pizza. And it's towards the end, and he's sitting on a desk, and underneath the desk is a garbage can. And a young woman on the team comes over with an empty plate, which she clearly wants to throw away. And so she's trying to figure out how to get the garbage can out from under him, right? And she says, "I need to." And she's clearly about to finish her sentence with "get the garbage can" and ask him to move. And he looks at her and he spreads his legs and he says, "Get between my legs." Uh-huh. And that was like that. So now I have a much worse problem that I have to deal with as a leader. And again, it was my responsibility to respond in the moment very strongly to that kind of bullying, and which has now become harassment, because bullying plus power is harassment. And once again, in this case, I did not respond the way that I should have. I didn't respond with the kind of strength. So those are some examples of bias, prejudice, bullying. Now, let me double click on this you statement. You know, you can't talk to, because I learned that from my daughter when she was in third grade. Mm-hmm. So she was getting bullied at school, and I was sort of coaching her to use an I statement to say, "I feel sad when you," and she bangs her fist on the table and she said, "Mom, he is trying to make me feel sad. Why would I tell him he succeeded?" And I'm like, you are right, from the mouth of babes, right?
And so
what we figured out is that telling him, in some cases, she could say, you can't talk to me like that, just to sort of, a you statement pushes the other person away, whereas an I statement invites them in. Or if that felt like it was going to escalate the situation too much, she could say, what's going on for you here? But the idea is that she was now in charge. She was now asking him the questions. She wasn't responding to him.
So I found it really interesting in this chapter, because so many times you're talking about many times where you don't respond, that you respond poorly or you just don't respond at all. There's the silence factor. And Jennifer's work, Jennifer Freyd,
Jennifer Freyd.
Right. And you sent her to me, and we had her on the podcast around the institutional silence. And you write in the book, quote, confrontation has obvious costs and hidden benefits. Silence has hidden costs and obvious benefits. The more aware you are of both the hidden costs and the hidden benefits, the better your decision will be. Because sometimes silence is the choice, but too often it's often the wrong choice.
Yes, I think I want to express great compassion for people who do choose to be silent or feel that they don't have a choice, because sometimes it really is too risky to speak out. And I don't want to rob people who are harmed by injustice of their right to remain silent, because you do have a right to remain silent if you're the person harmed. If you're playing any other role in this scenario, however, you do not have a right to remain silent. You have an obligation to speak up. If you observe this, you have an obligation to intervene.
Yeah.
You don't have to necessarily intervene directly, but you've got to at the very least go to the person who is harmed and talk to them afterwards. I'll give you an example of two times. One time during an interview. And so in an interview, there's definitely a power asymmetry, because I'm looking for a job and this other person is going to give me a job. In which I experienced some form of bias. And once I spoke up and I got the job, and another time I didn't speak up and I didn't get the job. And so these are some of the kind of hidden costs. But like if there's one thing this book changes, I hope it's the default to silence. So early on in my career, I had been working in Russia. I described the situation I found myself in the introduction to the book. It was not a good scene. I was experiencing, as I mentioned, all of those, everything from bias to the physical violations. And so finally I got out of that job and I'm looking for another job. And I really needed this job. I think I had like $12 in my bank account. And I had been introduced to this company. I really liked the company. I had really come to like and admire the CEO of the company, who was a Holocaust survivor who had started the company to support his family when he was still a teenager. And he said to me towards the end of the interview process, and at this point, I really want the job. He says to me, Russia is a really sexist society. How are you going to deal with it? And I was pissed off, because it sounded to me like he thought it was all my job to deal with sexism in Russia. And I felt like as my employer, it would be his job to have my back. And all this other stuff had happened to me. And so I said, before I even had time to think about what I was saying, I said, yes, Russia is also a very anti-Semitic society, but I know plenty of Jews who are doing really well there. And then as soon as those words were out of my mouth, I wanted the ground to open up and swallow me. I thought, God, why did I just say that? Mm-hmm. And luckily, he loved that I said it. And he was like, hired, you know, you've got the job. Now I know how you're going to. And so that was... Maybe I would have gotten the job even if I hadn't pushed back so hard on him and so directly on him, but I wouldn't have taken the job. I wouldn't have entered into the job with an open heart. I would have been sort of, there would have been that lingering. So that was kind of one of the hidden costs of silence. Now let's fast forward many years. And now I am the mother of young twins and I'm interviewing for a new job. And in this case, it's interesting. I had more than $12 in my bank account. Mm-hmm. I was pretty secure in my career. So you would think I would be more likely to confront this stuff than I was earlier in my career. But I'm interviewing at this company, and I like the company, and I like the founders quite a lot. And one of the founders towards the end of the interview process says to me, you know, one of the things that I really love that we do is we do yoga together every night at 7 p.m. as a team. And I'm reeling. I'm thinking, okay, so you do it at 7, it's over at 8, I'm going to be home at 9. I will never see my children. Mm-hmm. And on one hand, totally sympathetic to him, because 5 years before I had kids, I would have thought doing yoga at 7 would have been a lot of fun too. Like, I got it. But I didn't say anything. I just kind of withdrew from the interview process. It was almost... And not only did I withdraw, I didn't withdraw consciously. I sort of just started bumbling around. I was unable to answer. It was like my brain sort of melted in the face of this. And I got to know this guy later. And I can say with 100% certainty now that if I had said, whoa, that's not going to work for me or anybody else you want to hire who might have children, then I'm sure he would have changed the time of the yoga. You know, it just hadn't occurred to him. And so there was a big cost of not, I cost myself a job being unwilling to speak up. So I think I have great empathy for not knowing what to say, but I really want to change it. I want to help people. I want to help people feel that they can say something should they choose to.
Yeah, and that's what you're doing. This made me think of, we're having Scott O'Neill on the podcast coming up in a few weeks.
I love Scott.
Right, and you have a story that is around the same topic, right? He almost lost his best female sales executive.
Yeah. So there's a couple of great stories that Scott told me that are in the book, but there was a saleswoman on his team who was the number one performer, and then she came to him and she said she was going to leave because she didn't see a role for herself at the company. And he couldn't understand this because he had worked really hard to hire women at the company, and certainly for sports, it was a much more diverse leadership team than is out there. But it turned out that there were no women who were parents on his executive team. And so she understandably sort of had this idea that I'm going to have to leave when I have kids. And so he realized he needed senior executives. He needed to increase his diversity. He needed more women who were leading different kinds of lives on his executive team. And he made it a priority to go out and make sure that he was hiring working mothers as well as working fathers. Because he said, and it was very interesting, he said he's a very committed parent, and he attends his kids' sports games and is very, very active as a parent. And yet that wasn't going to do it for her. He understood that people need role models. People really need role models. And that was what was going to help. And he did manage to retain this wonderful salesperson because he went out and hired someone who had taken 6 years off, actually, to raise her kids and was re-entering the workforce. And often people who take time off find it difficult to re-enter the workforce. But he was committed to fight. For him, that was a feature, not a bug, the fact that she had taken 6 years off. And she wound up being one of his most valuable employees, the woman who he hired, too. So I really admired that story from Scott.
So one of our most profitable areas of the business is the summer camps that we do for kids.
Mm-hmm. Which my kids attended, by the way.
Yeah, great. And the reason that happened is because my wife and I had kids.
Yes.
We took our kids to a summer camp and realized Second City could be doing it. And Anne at the time was running the training center. And so it was like, no one would have come up with that idea if we hadn't been in that position to then bring it back to the business. So this diversity among teams is just crucial. And we have to understand that diversity means a lot of different things, right?
Yes.
Neurodiversity, it's all that stuff. But this lines up perfectly.
I also think it's really important. I want to give a shout out to all the people out there who don't have kids, because I didn't have kids till I was 40 and 41, actually. And for a long time, I felt like I needed work-life balance too. Because I wanted to focus on my writing, and because I need a lot of sleep, and for all the, I mean, there's a lot of different ways that we, in which we need work-life balance. And so let's make sure we're also optimizing for people who don't. Having kids is not the, it is wonderful, but it's not the be all end all. There's other ways to find meaning in life.
For sure. I was really struck, by, a thing you brought up in the book, which was about the writing of the book, that revolved around Zach Shore, who's a historian who helped edit the book.
Yes.
Talk to us about that.
So Zach, by the way, if you are writing a book, go hire Zach Shore right now. we'll drop his website into the show notes. So Zach is a historian and he's blind. And Zach can read faster than anyone I've ever, he reads at 6X. I don't know if you listen to Audible. If I'm really feeling awake, I can listen at 2X. I don't even hear words. And when, you know, so his mind is incredibly sharp. He's able to turn things around faster than just about anybody. So I really loved working with Zach and appreciated what he's able to do for the book. At the same time, another person who helped me on the book, Breeze Harper, pointed out that I tend to use the word see in an ableist way. When what I really mean is understand or notice, I use the word see. And I realized two things. One is that I was perhaps offending Zach, which was the last thing I wanted to do because I cared about him and I like him very much. And two, I realized that this was hurting my ability to choose the right words, this sort of bias, ableist language. And I talked to Zach about it and he said, you know, what I'm really focused on is the fact that such a huge percentage of blind people are unemployed when they could do the work, as he had just proven to me. And I realized that the words really matter and that this kind of language was contributing to this massive unemployment, unnecessary unemployment, these wasted talents out there that were not hiring, even though they can do the work. So I really cared about this. I really agreed with Breeze. I really thought I was aware of my ableist language. And right before I sent the final version of the book into my editor, I thought, well, I should do a search and just check how I use the word see in this manuscript. Guess how many times I used the word see in the wrong way. And it's not that long of a book. It's 350 pages. Guess how many times?
I know how many times.
Well, oh, yeah, because you read the book. 99 times. 99 times. I was staggered by this. And so this is one of the things I talk about in the book is quantify your bias. So doing that search was a way for me to quantify my biased use of language. I am more careful now. I am better about not using sloppy sight metaphors, inaccurate sight, but I still do it. It is hard to change these habits.
It is hard. But that's why, and we've talked about this so many times, that's why you need to practice. You have to find ways. And the book's really good with that because you don't offer, you're so not prescriptive in terms of here's your script. Literally, people want you to give them a script and you can't because context changes. But what you do offer is like, here's like 7 or 8 different things that you can maybe look at. And there was even software that can, you know, for hiring sites, right? I thought that was a fascinating idea.
Yeah. I think it is really useful to get the most important, I mean, you know, I love feedback. The most important thing I think that I did in the course of writing this book was asking people and paying people actually to read the book and bust my biases and to point out to me the things that I was saying and the words that I was using and sort of the habits of thought that I had fallen into just because of the world in which we live.
Yeah. And, you know, I know there's people who are listening to this who are like, everyone's just being too sensitive. But, you know, you say in the book, I mean, that essentially that sort of phrase is essentially a refusal to listen.
Yes. Yes. And in fact, one time here's another word that we often use inappropriately. I had tweeted something and I used the word crazies in an inaccurate and sloppy way. And somebody pointed it out to me very gently on Twitter, very kindly. And so then I tweeted out, I made this mistake. I know a lot of other people make this mistake. And so I'm going to share it with you. And I got a number of people were like, you're too sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. And it's hard for a woman to respond to this, you're too sensitive comment. So mm-hmm. I didn't respond immediately. And luckily, a colleague of mine, Russ Laraway, upstander extraordinaire, jumped into the stream. And he said, look, for the you're too sensitive crowd. And then he said, let's do an ROI. How hard is it for you to change your word? And what is the impact that it has when you change the words you use? And it turns out, it's a little hard to change your language, but it's not that hard. And the impact is tremendous, tremendous. And so the ROI is very positive.
Dolly Chug, who wrote the great book, The Person You Mean to Be, she looks at it this way. And I love this way of like, we should be looking at this stuff like we upgrade our tech. We know we're constantly getting, I just did it. I just had iOS update. And it's like, update your language. We have new language now.
Yeah. And those updates, it's a little bit of a pain in the neck when you have to update.
But your password, you got to plug it in.
I don't know.
It's work. Well, I mean, like, you know, change is hard. It's funny this year, all these things that have happened this year, as painful as they are just rife with opportunity to do better.
Yes. Yes.
The timing of this book coming out, given where we are right now, right, which is this, like, we're starting to see some light.
Yes.
But what we can't do is take our foot off the pedal.
Yes. And I think there's a couple of words that I am really trying to think about a better way to talk about it, because it is work, but it also is joy. It is when you get this stuff, when you start to see things improve because you notice that you have been making a mistake in the way you're talking and the way you're treating people, and you get it right and you build better relationships, like that's like what gives life meaning as far as I'm concerned. That is joy. And so, yes, it's work, but it's a kind of joyous, it can be a kind of joyous work. I started this company to help leaders and teams put the ideas of just work into practice. And I started it with Trier Bryant, who's an amazing, amazing person. And she and I have had so much fun working together. And just the other day we were recording a class that we're teaching together, and I used a master analogy, and she stopped me in the moment. I was like, God, like, we use these words so casually. I think I said, I was talking about an agency problem, and I said HR sometimes has three masters, and that is not what I meant. What I meant is that HR is accountable to three different parts of the organization that have very different interests. It's an agency problem. So once again, I was using language that was referring to slavery and one of the worst institutions in human history. And that was harming people. That was, that's part of how denial works, is we make light of these things. And it's not light. They are not light. And when we learn to use different language. And so this was not a heavy conversation between Trier and me. It was an easy conversation that immediately helped me use better language. And so I think when we can learn to have these conversations with, Kelly, you coined this, agency and grace, then all of a sudden we're having fun working together again. And
right,
I think that's
right.
that's what we need to do.
I know. And I think, you know, I always talk about replacing blame with curiosity and assuming good intent as a starting point, which I think because of my context and my privilege, I can do that. There's others who can't. And, and I think we need to acknowledge that and acknowledge that these situations aren't static in any way, and they never will be. So it's constantly evolving and changing and will take swerves or whatever. But if we remain open to the experience of being a lifelong learner, if we want to really sort of celebrate, you know, all humans, it really sort of comes down to the stuff that we were taught when we're, you know, in kindergarten, you know, the basic building blocks of like share and be nice.
Yeah.
And somehow that gets like drugged out of us by the time we get to the workplace and it's the opposite suddenly.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that the assuming good intent is really interesting and important because it is, you're right. It's easier for you and me to assume good intent than that, because basically the world has been pretty good to us.
Yes.
But I also think that it is useful. It is a useful attribute to be able to try to assume good intent. But I also think that can be weaponized. So sometimes if I make a mistake and then I tell someone else to assume good intent of me, I think that's also kind of a refusal to listen. I mean, imagine, let's take a simple example. I am stepping on someone's toe. And someone says, "You're stepping on my toe." I would not continue to step on their toe and say, "Well, I didn't mean to step on." I would get off the damn toe.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's really important to assume good intent of others, but not to demand that they assume it of us.
That's right. I want to ask you about one more thing, but I'm also realizing that if I make you say a yes and story, it's going to be like your fourth yes and story. So we don't have to do that.
Yes and. Let's do a yes and story.
Okay. All right. So in a second, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story.
Okay.
One line from the book I just want you to unpack because I think I kind of love it and I'd not thought about it, which is, quote, "Few things will kill good communication on a team faster than moral grandstanding." Talk to us. This feels personal for you.
Yes. Well, moral grandstanding happens in so many different ways, and it happens so often today. And so my experience with moral grandstanding happened, well, I have a lot of experiences, but here's the story I tell in the book. This is when I was working at Google. And at Google, there are bikes. You take bikes everywhere because it's a very spread out campus and there's no parking. It's a pain in the ass. So if you're going to be on time to your meetings, you have to bike. And at this period in time, my boss was like 2 miles away. She was in a building that was on the outer edge of campus. And for some reason, the bikes, if you biked there, there would be no bike. So then you were stuck 2 miles away from your next meeting, and which started in 5 minutes. And so I got in the habit of bringing my bike into her office, into the building when I went there, so that I could get back to my next meeting. And this was kind of a violation of the norms, because if everybody did that, then you know, there wouldn't be as many bikes. But I couldn't figure out what else to do, and somebody started posting on the internet the most ungoogly thing. And then they started taking pictures of me. And pretty soon I was this bike thief villain. And this moral outrage, the moral grant. And it was, it was really awful. Mm-hmm. And that was just about bikes. Like, imagine if it were about an issue that mattered more than you know, the company bike system. And so I think so often, there's another story I tell about somebody at a company was organizing an event, and they called it a powwow. And it turned out, but the person was an Ohlone person, but nobody knew that. And everybody piled on, like, how could you do this? Blah, blah. And so it was this moral grandstanding. And this poor person felt sort of awful. So I think, and it's much more likely for that to happen online
Yes.
than it is at in a dinner party. If you started moral grandstanding, you would notice people kind of looking at you and you would back down.
Yeah.
But online, it gets more, the outrage piles up like a snowball. So I think it's a real problem, and I don't have all the solutions to the problem, but it's a form of bullying.
It is a form of bullying. Well, and it's at that, and you write in the book about, like, you can't, to the solution with a bully is not to mimic the behavior. And so much of this, and we've talked about this before, I think, you know, like, you know, we're a couple of lefties. The left does it just as much, if not more, than the right in terms of that sort of piling on stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Both sides do it. I mean, I think interestingly, it tends to happen at the extremes on both sides. It happens. And again, this is another problem, probably a problem that I helped to create, but
in the technology community.
Yeah,
you did.
But I did. This is a whole other thing I need to write about. but I think that online, the thing that gets clicks, like, you get what you measure, and what social networks, what ad systems measure is clicks. You tend to get more clicks for more extreme,
right?
Because it creates this emotional charge
fueled by outrage.
Yeah, by outrage or something. Mm-hmm. And so these systems take us to the extremes in a way that real life wouldn't.
Yeah, one of my recent podcasts with a tech ethicist said it's not that the social networks are showing you what you want to see; they're showing you what you can't help but look at.
That is a really good way of putting it.
Yeah.
That is a really good way of putting it.
All right. So we always end the podcast asking our guest for a yes and story. You know this. So do you have a yes and story for us?
I do have a yes and story. And in fact, it's not just one story. This yes and, it turns out, is the most effective tool that I have found for responding to moral grandstanding online. Mm-hmm. So very often someone will respond to me that I've done or said this horrible thing. And it just saying yes and is such a good way to make this person understand that I have tried to take their point of view into account, mm-hmm. and I want to share my own. So try it on Twitter. Every time someone gets mad at you on Twitter, yes and to them. It is a great tool.
That's I love that. No one has ever suggested that, and I think you're right. Well, Kim Scott, thank you.
It really works.
Yeah, it does work. Kim, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. Loved our conversation.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
one survives.
From adulthood, no one survives.